Hello and welcome. This is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in today for Rose Aguilar. The mass shootings this week in El Paso, Dayton, and Gilroy have shaken this country to its core, and it's also been a situation where debates have been sparked over everything from gun control to the role of social media, violence against immigrants, and maybe most importantly, the impact that the president is having on the soul of the nation. Maybe you've noticed there's been a not-so-subtle shift in how the media is covering these issues. For example, the banners at the bottom of the TV screen now refer openly to statements by President Trump as racist. Maybe you've noticed field reporters seem to have a little less objectivity. Their voices crack a little when they describe a shooting scene or the aftermath of that massive raid on a Mississippi plant where children are crying for their parents. Today, we're going to be joined by a trio of reporters who've covered extremism in general, and we're going to discuss whether news coverage is changing the climate in the country, or perhaps the other way around, is the climate in the country changing media coverage. We're going to start with joining us from Berkeley Live, Will Carlos. Will is a correspondent for Reveal, and he specializes in covering extremism. Thank you so much for being with us, Will Carlos.
Thanks for having me on.
Also from Portland, Oregon, for the full hour, both Will Carlos and Jason Wilson. Jason is an Australian-born writer, and he's a columnist for The Guardian. Hi, Jason Wilson. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you.
And from Los Angeles, we'll have her only for our first half hour, but we're very grateful that she could join us, Esmeralda Bermudez. She's a staff writer at the LA Times, and in 2016, she was part of a Pulitzer Prize-winning team who won the prize for their coverage of the San Bernardino terrorist attack. Esmeralda Bermudez, thank you so much for being here for the first half hour.
Thank you.
As we do every week on the Media Roundtable, we'd start with the kudos. We'd like to open the show by highlighting good reporting and giving kudos to journalists who've done a good job in covering the week's news. So, Esmeralda, let's start with you. What stands out for you this week in coverage?
Well, I think I probably have to be a little bit selfish, but it is appropriate. Because just a day after the shooting, the massacre in El Paso, the LA Times did, deploy about a half dozen Latino reporters across the LA region and parts of California to ask Latinos specifically, how are you feeling? What's the mood been like in the community? And I think we ended up with a very nuanced story that ran on Monday that really got at all the layers of the heartbreak, the anger, the indignation, the fear, that feeling of, those questions of, should I continue speaking Spanish to my children given what's happened? Will my last name or being on my uniform or outside my business, the building of my business make me a target? Should I stay away from church? Should I stay away from shopping centers? All these very complex and very personal questions that a lot of Latinos are asking themselves at this time when there's so many emotions that are very palpable. And I think it really came through in that story.
It's not self-serving at all, Esmeralda. I think that's a nuanced change in how the coverage is going, and kudos are indeed due. Jason Wilson, your kudos for the week?
I hope this doesn't sound like a cop-out, but I think generally, as you were saying in your introduction, I've seen it at the LA Times, I've seen it amongst, in other newspapers, and certainly among my colleagues at The Guardian. Across the media, I think people are finally really taking the opportunity to have a serious discussion about the contribution of racism, the white supremacist movement that is burgeoning in this country to these kinds of acts of public violence. I've really noticed a general change, with some exceptions, which I won't mention. There are still some mastheads, I think, who aren't quite grasping this, but most outlets that I've been reading have really taken the opportunity to reflect on the connections between racism, xenophobia and violence.
I actually agree with you. We're going to get into that a bit in the hour. Will Carlos, what coverage stands out for you this week?
So I would point everybody towards a fantastic essay written by a guy called Robert Evans on Bellingcat. It may not be a publication people are familiar with, but it's bellingcat.com, bellingcat.com. And this is, it's titled The El Paso Shooting and the Gamification of Terror. And Robert Evans is a guy I've been following on Twitter for a while. He's an expert essentially on 8chan and the sort of awful online world where a lot of these killers are talking to each other and coming from. And he foresaw the incident in El Paso and in fact has done an amazing job sort of analyzing it and talking about how these young men are kind of competing with each other to get higher body counts and are being, you know, cheered on by a rather nasty corner of the internet. So I'd urge everybody to go read that. It's The El Paso Shooting and the Gamification of Terror by Robert Evans.
Even this morning, there was another report of someone entering a Walmart in Missouri, dressed in fatigues, wearing a bulletproof vest, armed with ammunition and a gun, almost as if there is a one-upsmanship going on. It is so chilling. It's just remarkable. So he seems to have portended what was to come, God forbid. But let's get into the discussion. This is... in El Paso, certainly one of the deadliest hate crimes ever against Latinos in the United States. Esmeralda, I'd like to get your thoughts on, in general, outside your own publication, in general, how the tragedy was covered and the tragedies in Dayton and Gilroy by extension. Your thoughts?
You know, you just mentioned it. You said this has been one of the deadliest hate crimes ever against Latinos. And I think for many of the Latinos that I've been communicating with in the last few days, that was their front page banner in their mind every single day, every waking hour. And I was watching those front pages, you know, particularly with newspapers. I don't own a TV myself, but I was watching the newspapers closely, and it was really... difficult to watch that in itself, that emphasis on that news was not placed nationwide. I mean, by the third day, you know, when the same day that the names of all the victims came out and it was name after name in Latino names, none of those faces were shown or the names were not mentioned. Obviously, they're not going to be mentioned in the headlines, but there was no emphasis placed on the third day. The emphasis was entirely on Trump, you know, denouncing racism, Trump, you know, saying hate is not good and calling for unity. This was in the first 72 hours. You couldn't have, if you would have been looking at those U.S. headlines, you wouldn't have known that this incredible tragedy, historic tragedy in the darkest moment, you know, for Latinos, you wouldn't have known that this was happening in the United States.
So what is the role of the media in creating that narrative or lack of same?
Well, you know, I think ultimately this is a symptom. The things that we see today and that we've seen, and this is not the first time, obviously, but it is symptomatic of newsrooms not having enough Latino reporters, enough folks on their staff at all levels, whether it's the writers or the top editors, to be able to understand the nuances of the culture and to hit the streets immediately and start interviewing people in English and in Spanish. One of the stories that the LA Times, my colleague Paloma Esquivel and I are working on is speaking to Latinos who have been in the U.S. anywhere between 100 to up to 400 years. I'm a Salvadoran immigrant who came here in 1985 after the Civil War. She's been here since before U.S. soil was, before this land was belonged to the U.S. And so between both of us, we have a very nuanced view of the community. And, it, you know, it's amazing when we first started talking to people about that topic, my colleague found a woman down in Texas whose roots date back to the 1600s. Her great-grandfather was killed by a lynch mob 101 years ago. And she's been facing discrimination with her husband for a number of years. They found refuge in El Paso. And she said the day of the massacre, she turned to her husband without knowing about the manifesto or that it was race-related. And she said to him, she said, it's here. They've come to kill the Mexicans. here we are 101 years later having to deal with the same thing that her great-grandfather dealt with. That is nuance. That, those are the things that I would love to see, you know, that we need to see, that history. A lot of the focus, I think, often is on newly arrived immigrants, and obviously it needs to be because it's an important topic, but I think Latinos are not this monolithic amoeba that just all crawls in the same direction. There's incredible, just detail and nuance that must be captured, and that can only come a lot of times from having people who know the community, who grew up in the community.
Jason Wilson, I saw the cover for Time magazine, and it has just a melange of pictures, photographs from the shooting scenes, and one word, the word enough. But my question for you, Jason Wilson, is it, after all the shootings, after all the mass murders, after all the incidents that have been covered, have we finally hit critical mass? And if you think so, if you think that's the case, what role has the media played in bringing it to this point?
Oh, boy, it sounds like you're asking me for some optimism, and I'm not entirely sure, unfortunately, that we have reached a point where, our leaders are actually going to take this problem seriously. I think that for all the talk from the president and the people around him about some kind of reform of gun laws and some kind of extension of background checking, we have heard these kinds of noises in the wake of mass shootings before from Republicans, and it is the Republicans who are the stumbling block here to some kind of national reform. I think that the people in the United States, it seems to me, largely do want those reforms to happen and are supportive of making it more difficult for felons or troubled people to acquire firearms. But that's not, unfortunately, even what's being talked about is not going to solve the problem. The young men in the last week or so who committed these crimes, may have passed a background check. So, the real problem is the quantity of firearms. Look, and I think that for the most part, that discussion at least, I absolutely take Esmeralda's point about what's missing from this discussion. But on that point at least, I think we are having a pretty reasonable discussion in the media about what those kinds of reforms might look like. The question, as always, is whether that will make any difference politically, given who's in the White House and who's in charge of the Senate.
I'm always surprised when these things happen that it seems so urgent to cover what's happening now that the media very often doesn't put things into any kind of historical context. For example, the fact that one of the first acts of the president was to sign a bill that made it easier for people who are mentally ill to have access to firearms. So people who have been adjudged to be so incompetent as to be unable to handle their own finances and Social Security payments, they have been adjudged to be incompetent in that way. But no, it's okay to have a gun. So why that's not being superimposed over the sudden discussion about, well, we think that mental illness is part of the problem. So I'll ask Esmeralda, do you see a shortcoming in the media and the inability to bring historical facts forward and superimpose them over what's happening in the news today?
Absolutely. I mean, we the news cycle just moves so fast, and I think and this applies to just about everything, right? Not just what you just mentioned, but as well, with Trump specifically, this is someone who began his entire campaign 4 years ago with the words, Mexico doesn't send its best, it sends its rapists, its drug dealers. He's attacked a federal judge's impartiality because he's Mexican. He's at a rally joked and kind of chuckled along when someone said, shoot immigrants. And he's constantly used the word invasion. And so there's all that context, that drumbeat that for a lot of Latinos has felt like it's gotten closer and closer to the front, their front door. And speaking about the greater issue here, I mean, the most heated debate is over immigrants, right? And without documentation or asylum seekers at America's doorstep, we're really talking about Central Americans there. And there's been an incredible lack of context and history talking about what created those dynamics dating back decades, right? I'm from El Salvador. I fled El Salvador because of a U.S. sponsored war that the U.S. spent billions of dollars on back in the 80s and resulted in so many deaths and U.S.-backed death squads. And so it just goes back so many generations, you know, that have to do with economy and bananas and coffee and farms owned by the U.S. And I think a lot of Americans don't hear those things. They think, you know, specifically Salvadorans, they think pupusas and MS-13. And you don't stop and read so much in the paper or watch on TV, you know, the all these dynamic, very thorough historic moments that created these floods of immigration that you get every once in a while.
And how does the media address the fact that sometimes people are so shaken or taken by what's happening in the news today that they really don't have an historical context, like as you just described? What are the economic conditions that the U.S. may have had a role in that are sending people flooding across the border? What do you do? You print more papers? Do you add more news time? How do you get that context inserted in the coverage of these high-profile stories?
Well, I think exactly that, what you said. I mean, when you tell stories, you leave, I speak in newspaper terms, but you leave, you know, paragraphs. You make sure that you, in the stories that you put together, that you write paragraphs with that history or that context, or print more explanatory pieces, print more timelines that give you a sense of the past. I mean, here in our story that ran on Monday, we literally, the top of the story was opened up by talking about the political waves that have washed over California, Arizona, like the repatriation of Mexicans in the 1930s, Proposition 187 in the 1990s, the Minuteman protests, and you know, America's toughest sheriff, Joe Arpaio, and his hardline policing tactics. So from the top of the story, you knew that this type of tension and animosity toward Latinos is nothing new. And even so, I mean, some of the most veteran folks in the middle of these front lines are feeling like they've never seen anything like this. There's this feeling, as someone told me, that war has been declared against the community. So there's this history, and then there's the fact that this really, right now in this moment, really does feel historic and different, given all that context. And it's all a package deal that has to be delivered on a regular basis to readers and to viewers and listeners.
Jason Wilson and Will Carlos, I'm going to throw this question out to either or both of you. Speaking of things that have never been seen before, no one has ever dealt with a president like this in modern times. It's been described as trying to drink from a fire hose. Every day brings a new affront. And so I'm wondering, will coverage of these important issues that have been brought up in the wake of these shootings, will those issues just fade with the president's next headline-grabbing actions? Jason Wilson, let's start with you.
He's very adept at distracting critics, at overwhelming the news cycle with, as you say, outrageous statements. His brand of attack politics, he didn't pause, you know, even while he was traveling between the sites of mass shootings. You know, he sent out a tweet attacking a critic. I think that while we're becoming more aware of that, it seems very difficult for media organizations to deal with. I think, though, that we do need to stay on this story in particular. We need to stay on the connections between the kinds of hatreds that, the president appears to have emboldened and acts of horrific mass violence. We need to keep on this. We need to keep talking about this. We need to stay on this story for a while. And not be distracted by what the president wants us to talk about, which is, his political animosities and his efforts to silence his critics. I think it's more important than ever, and we really do need to keep a focus on all of the things that Esmeralda has mentioned as well. You know, the fact that there are large groups of people in this country who have been defined as unwelcome aliens or enemies by the president and people around him. We need to keep talking about that as well.
Will Carlos, at some point you just wonder how much outrage can the media actually absorb and report? I think it was at a rally just last week. The president said, and I quote, "How do you stop these people? You can't." And somebody in the crowd shouted, "Shoot them." And he laughs in that way that he does and says, "No, that's only in the panhandle you can get away with that stuff." It's just so outrageous, but it's followed on the heels of yet another outrage. How does the media handle something like that, Will?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I was talking about this with an NYU professor of journalism yesterday, and he was sort of laying it out like this, that Donald Trump has broken all the rules when it comes to this kind of long-established sort of social contract between the president and journalists. Until Donald Trump came along, there was this sort of unwritten rule between how presidents will be covered by the American media. And there are sort of stock phrases that will be rolled out. And we saw them being rolled out in the last few days. You know, there were newspapers with headlines like, a consoler-in-chief and things like that when he was going to these cities. And that's the sort of stock phrase that has always applied to presidents, and that you've always had this sort of friendly relationship between the media and presidents. And all that's gone now. All that is going out of the window. And in a weird way, I think that's kind of a good thing. I wish it wasn't happening in this way. I wish we didn't have a president who was tweeting and saying racist things and fomenting hatred and driving people to go out and kill people, which I believe firmly that he is doing. But I do take some solace in the fact that the mold is being broken, especially as a Brit. I mean, in the United Kingdom, the way that politicians are treated by the media is with a huge amount of skepticism, a huge amount of sort of, I don't want to say disrespect, but there is that everything politicians say in the United Kingdom is treated with a huge pinch of salt by journalists. They're challenged on everything they say. And I don't think that really happens in the States. And if it takes Donald Trump to break that mold and to show people that, hey, presidents are human and they lie and they weasel out of things and they commit sort of horrible acts, then at least, you know, the media is going to have to move forwards, having learned some lessons and having thrown out the rule book and having to reinvent itself. Like, that's the one positive thing that I can see coming out of all of this. I'm an optimist at heart, but I do see that breaking of the mold as a positive thing for U.S. journalism.
I would like to step in and add something, if I may.
Esmeralda Bermudez, go right ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, well, you know, when we're talking about Latinos nationwide, we're talking about 50 million people. One out of four Americans in this country is Latino. And the vast majority, I think it was like 80-something percent, are American-born. I've been covering Latinos for about 15 years now, and my role, I've always seen it as, of course, to step into the fray when it comes to issues of immigration when necessary, and child separation and detention centers and those things. But also on a day-to-day basis, I just want to tell stories about Latinos. Complex, you know, sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes painful. Just the day-to-day lives. We spend so much time in the roaring river, you know, just trying to just catch our breath. And meanwhile, people are living their lives out on the banks, and they're building, and they're living, and they're loving, and they're hating, and they're doing all these things. And I think that's what also helped to chip away at this feeling that it's just this big blob of people, when really there's so many layers to the community. And I think those things go hand in hand. It's not just about being on the front lines of this immigration battle. It's about really remembering that we all have universal elements that we can connect with, and it might be, I've written about the love of Vicks Vapor Rub, and you can't imagine how many, and the connection Latinos have to that product, and you can't imagine how many people, Germans, you know, Jewish community, all these folks from all over the world felt a connection because they remembered that from their childhood. And I know it sounds silly because it's Vapor Rub, but that's exactly what I mean. It just kind of step back and on a day-to-day basis have people just covering the community and understanding and knowing the community.
Esmeralda Bermudez, staff writer at the L.A. Times, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, so glad you were able to join us for the first half of the program and we could get your valuable insights on the issues we've been talking about today. Sorry we're going to lose you for the second half of the program, but thank you so much for the perspective that you could bring.
Thank you. I appreciate you making space for this conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you. Jason Wilson and Will Carlos are going to stay with us. We're going to be talking about the week's news, the objectivity or lack of it on reporters' parts this week in their coverage. Reporters have been on camera kind of weeping. Their voice is cracking a bit. How has the coverage this week shifted how we're looking at news coverage? We hope you'll stay with us. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is the Your Call Friday Media Roundtable. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea, drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or feel free right now, 866-798-8255, to weigh in on our discussion today. Today we're talking about media coverage of the massacre in the border city of El Paso, Texas. A white man shot and killed at least 22 people at that El Paso Walmart on Saturday. The shooter posted online just minutes before the massacre, saying that the attack was the result of what he called a Hispanic invasion of Texas that echoed the words of President Donald Trump. He also detailed a white nationalist, anti-immigrant view in his four-page manifesto. So how has news coverage this week changed, subtly or not so subtly? Is the coverage changing because we have reached a saturation point? We're joined today in the second half hour by Will Carlos. He's a correspondent for Reveal, and he has covered extremism. And Jason Wilson is an Australian-born writer and columnist for The Guardian. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. And we invite your calls at 866-798-8255. Another journalist is on the line and has been waiting to join the conversation. Matt McFetridge, thank you so much for holding on. What are your thoughts on coverage this week? You've actually been in Gilroy this week, yes, covering the aftermath of that shooting?
I was in El Paso from Saturday through yesterday, and you know, I pretty much saw the whole thing unfold. And I think you're really bringing up a good point. Reporters and anchors really kind of had their hearts on their sleeve for this one. Mm. And I think there's just fatigue of covering shooting after senseless shooting all over this country. And the fact that Dayton happened just hours after El Paso was just insane. And, you know, particularly the Latin networks, Telemundo and Univision, those folks were really passionate in their reporting and really kind of letting it all hang out, so to speak. And I was impressed with it. I don't think it crosses the line journalistically whatsoever. I mean, these are horrid events. The Latinos in that Walmart were singled out by a racist, and you know, who used special caliber bullets to inflict, you know, heavy bodily damage. I mean, some of the victims had to have three or four surgeries because of the damage to their bodies. So if we're talking about the tone of the reporting from there, yeah, sure, there's always your vacuous TV person. But for the most part, I saw a lot of people who cared about the story and cared about the victims. And good to be part of the broadcast, Renee.
Thanks a lot, Matt. Good to hear from you. Will, you've covered extremism. You know, I thought it was interesting when the New York Times, under pressure, had to change its initial front page edition headline following Trump's speech. And the headline initially read, "Trump urges unity versus racism." And there was so much public outrage that they immediately changed that headline in a later edition. And the new headline read, "Assailing hate, but not guns." Why do you think the New York Times came under such pressure, and what do you think of them making that change? Well, let's start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the headline they ended up with was sufficient. I mean, you talked a lot about context and historical context, and your other guest, Esmeralda, it mentioned the importance of context. And unfortunately, when you write a headline like that that fails to point out the direct connections between that shooting and the man, you know, saying those words, then you do a disservice to your readers, I believe. So, but to address your broader point about how the media is tackling this, I think, you know, frankly, reporters like Jason and myself who cover this for a living, who cover hate and extremism for a living, have sort of watched in horror as the worlds that we pay attention to in our little sort of nerdy lives have become the biggest headlines in the world. And it's, you know, it's both, you know, it's both terrifying and horrifying. And at the same time, you take some sort of journalistic pride in the fact that at least we've been watching this stuff, and at least our editors were prescient enough to put us on it and to get us to cover it. So I think what we're seeing in the US media as a whole is the rest of the media world start to understand and come around to some of the reporting that some of us have been doing for a long time, and, you know, better inform themselves. And I wish that, you know, especially when it comes to TV and network news, I mean, the amount of times that these guys get this coverage completely wrong, completely off key, they fail to recognize, you know, what are pretty obvious links and connections that if they were to talk to experts and to have experts on their shows and to just call experts up and talk to them, they would see just how obvious those connections are. And so I hope that we're in a period of evolution. I hope that the sort of mainstream media, for lack of a better name, is coming round to and understanding these new worlds of hate and new worlds of extremism, and that they're going to start recognizing them for just how important and terrifying they really are.
Jason Wilson, you know, a lot of folks now are arguing that journalists have got to stop doing the false equivalencies and just reporting two sides of a story because they think that's important for journalists to do, but that is not going to inform readers and listeners and viewers of what is actually happening in what are really extraordinary times in our country, and that by not being willing to actually, even if they're accused of advocacy journalism, if they don't make it clear that there is one side that's right and one side that's wrong, that it actually helps normalize these unprecedented political times that we're living through. Is that beginning to happen, and should it, in your opinion?
I think it may be. Look, the heart and soul, the purpose of journalism is to tell the truth. You've got to be fair, but really what you need to do is tell your readers and your viewers the truth. And, you know, I think the New York Times example, the outcry that they faced over their headline is that there's a feeling from some people that some institutions of journalism, you know, prize decorum above the truth, a certain kind of decorum that's, I think, well, I go back to what Will said earlier, I think is specific to U.S., certain U.S. journalism institutions. And, you know, in the U.K., for all the flaws with some aspects of its media culture, you know, outlets are allowed to kind of have a point of view, you know, and outlets and their readers and the readers of other newspapers understand that. And I think that when you're dealing with the most hateful and poisonous ideologies that history has produced and the results of those ideologies. You know, you don't have to kind of both sides of that. There's no need to kind of consider whether that might be a legitimate point of view. Those of us, as Will said, who have been covering extremism for a long time, perhaps understand better how dangerous those ideologies and those worldviews can be. But I think that what people were reacting to with the New York Times situation was a situation where, yeah, a certain kind of journalistic decorum that has applied in the United States perhaps is starting to look a little bit obsolete given the shape that the politics and the culture is in.
Mm-hmm. 866-798-8255 is the number if you'd like to weigh in on this discussion about how the media is covering current events. Or you can drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Stephen in San Francisco. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a big supporter of the no notoriety movement. And speaking to the kudos portion of your program, I wanted to really praise KALW, excuse me, and I've also seen on PBS that they're not mentioning the shooter's names, referring to the 19-year-old shooter, the 24-year-old shooter. And I guess I could ask the panel, are you noticing some kind of trend towards other media outlets to be part of this no notoriety campaign?
Either Will or Jason, you want to weigh in on how effective it is to not give notoriety to these shooters?
Yeah, I think not naming the shooter is the easy part, and that's something I'm happy to do in my own reporting, and something that The Guardian has basically taken on board. I've been writing about the Christchurch shooter for months and months now in different pieces, and I've never referred to him as anything other than that except in the very initial reporting. There's a more difficult judgment to be made when it comes to talking about why these folks are doing what they do. So to what extent do you report on the contents of a manifesto? On the one hand, you know, clearly they've issued that manifesto in order to gain publicity for their views and in order to perhaps try to recruit people to their way of thinking. On the other hand, you do need to explain to your readers why this event has happened, and you do want your readers to have some information about this ideology so that they may be able to identify it if people around them are being kind of sucked into that. Not naming them is the easy bit, and then I think there are a lot of difficult judgments that are more situational that need to be made about the other aspects of the event and the political views of the people who might be involved. I'm not sure what Will thinks.
If I could add some context to this, because you know, many of your listeners might not realize this, that these shooters who have in the past been mislabeled as lone wolves, it's very, very clear at this point that these people are coming from a united and connected ideology. They're talking to each other online, sometimes literally communicating with each other, but they're communicating in the same places. They're saying the same things. They're sharing manifestos that put forward the same ideas. And that's extremely important in understanding why we're having this discussion about whether you should name shooters or not, because there is the fundamental desire of these people is, I believe, to become famous. That it's to get their names in the paper. But more than that, it's to get support from the hateful communities from which they come and where they have found a home and friendship and kinship and support. It sounds strange, but these people are looking for they're looking for kinship and friendship because they don't have it in their real lives, and they find it in these awful communities that are advocating terrible things. And so when we talk about whether it's important to name or not, I firmly believe that we shouldn't be naming. We should do whatever we can to try and black out the names of these people. I think that would go a massive way towards towards stemming the flow of these, and it would certainly turn a lot of these would-be shooters off if they weren't going to become famous. However, I think it's all but impossible to do. We expect basic information from police departments after a mass shooting, one of which, of course, is the shooter's name. And look, if the New York Times, the Guardian, the, you know, CNN don't, you know, even if they were all to sign a pact saying they're not going to name him, him or her, the name is going to get out. It's going to get out in blogs. It's going to get out in other publications. It's always going to get out. I think it's an interesting experiment. I'd like to see the major news organizations get together and sign some sort of a pact along those lines. And it's absolutely crucial, and I think would save lives, frankly. It would stop people from going out and committing these shootings if they didn't think they were going to get the sort of publicity that they so desperately crave.
Well, it seems like such a no-brainer. When it happened in New Zealand, the first thing the Prime Minister said was, we are not mentioning the shooter's name.
Yeah, if I could add something to what Will said there, which is all really great, and I agree. I think another way of looking at this, yes, their names are going to get out, and we can limit that, but, you know, people know the names of these people. I mean, another way to think about it is something that Esmeralda was pointing to earlier, which is, you know, we all need to do better at this. There really does need to be much more focus, much more attention to the victims of hate crimes and to the suffering of the victims and how victims are affected. And unfortunately, whether we name them or not name them or don't name them, there's far too much focus on the killers and not enough focus on the impact that their actions have. And I think that is something we can all think about more as well.
Wanted to make sure that we got our next caller in, Vicky in San Francisco. Vicky wanted to suggest a book for us to read.
Yes, this relates not only to what you're talking about at this immediate moment, which I couldn't agree more with the idea of that these folks are all connected and looking for support from their violent communities, but I wanted to point out that this violence is not new. The book that I'm talking about is a book called The End of the Myth by Greg Grandin. I just recently read it. I think it came out early this year. And it's about the history of this kind of violence and racism in North America beginning in the 1600s. And his idea is that each successive government of the United States pushed the violence to the frontier, and that the frontier violence grew as the U.S. was involved in more and more wars, and disaffected soldiers came back angry with guns, and they could be sent back out to the frontier to kill more indigenous people and more people from the Mexican border. And one president after another encouraged this, beginning with Andrew Jackson. And it's been a huge current in American history. And when finally we got to the manifest destiny of coast to coast, then we had to put the frontier out in foreign countries. So that's when Woodrow Wilson took us into World War I. That's when FDR took us into World War II. That's when JFK took us into space. That was another frontier. Now there's no more frontiers. So where is all this violence and hatred centered? On the border.
Thank you, Vicky. Okay. We appreciate that, and we appreciate the fact that it has to be put in historical context and international context, that this is something, it's a phenomenon that is existing thanks to social media outside our borders, and thanks to sites like 8chan, Cloudflare. These things are now international, and the fact that there is now, and either Jason or Will, I'd like for you to weigh in, there is now, arguably, with Fox News, one of the most critical components of any malevolent regime, and that's right, I'm characterizing it. If there is an evil intent, historically speaking, there had to be an information outlet that promoted and supported that regime. How important is it that there is such a thing now as, say, a Fox News? Even though this week, Tucker Carlson, of course, who's been a big supporter of President Trump's, said that the whole idea of white nationalism is just a hoax. His fellow anchor, Shepard Smith, directly opposed that. So Fox looks like it's doing a bit more of pushback on that. But how important is what's happening? How much of it is the result of having a Fox News?
I mean,
is this Jason?
This is Will.
This
sorry.
Is Will. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So firstly, I mean, talking about no notoriety, I wish as a society we could stop talking about Tucker Carlson, because the man's not a journalist. He's a, you know, he's a hack. He's a huckster. He doesn't deserve, I don't think, a place in a discussion about journalism. And secondly, Fox News is a they are a utterly partisan arm of the Trump government at this point. I don't think that anyone can seriously deny that. I mean, they parrot the president's talking points. They support him to the end. Okay, there's occasional voices that slip through that they accidentally get on who will criticize the president. But you know, from the deep financial ties to the close friendships to the direct connection between what President Trump sees on Fox News and what he goes out and tweets about or announces the next day, they are an arm of the Trump government. And of course they're vital in spreading Donald Trump's worldview, and they're a very effective propaganda machine. They're not journalists at this point.
Jason?
I think we'll appreciate this. I mean, coming from Australia, where News Corporation media properties absolutely dominate the media landscape, I mean, it's not just Fox is what I'm saying. It's News Corporation outlets everywhere. I have to say, tend to promote a point of view that's hostile to immigration, whether in the UK or Australia or here, hostile to refugees in particular in Australia. And that's led to kind of policies being instituted that mean that refugees who come by boat will simply never settle in Australia. You know, they've had a big hand in the UK in promoting a kind of climate of hostility to people even from the EU. You know, I think that there is worldwide, there's a kind of link now between a very powerful media company and a particular brand of right-wing populism, which is hostile to immigrants and hostile to a sort of liberal international order. I don't know if Will agrees with me there.
Will, do you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a worldwide trend being driven by, you know, close friends and allies of the Trump administration and other sort of populist nationalist leaders around the country. Absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly. And unfortunately, you know, Fox News as a legacy news organization, commands a certain amount of respect from people, commands a certain amount of allegiance, and people rely on Fox News to which was once, I believe, you know, at least slightly attempted to be impartial, or at least deal with the truth that Jason was talking about earlier. I see it as my personal job to tell people whenever I'm asked about this that you can't believe Fox News. Don't watch it. It's not news. It's not impartial. It's not factual. It is propaganda. And if you watch it, you are subjecting yourself to propaganda.
Well, with that, I'd like to invite you, Will, to give us your final thoughts. We've got about 3 minutes left. So if you would, looking forward in the week or so ahead, how do you anticipate coverage to continue? Of these shootings, of the president, do you have a prediction for what we can expect going forward?
I think the president will continue to try to drive the news cycle, aided by his cronies at Fox News, will try to drive the news cycle in a certain direction. I hope that the media, I'm glad that the media is having the discussion about how his actions and tweets and outbursts should be covered. I do hope that the broader mainstream media continues its trend to greater understanding of these white supremacist terrorists, who I believe pose the greatest threat to American lives at this point. I think that's absolutely indisputable, and I hope they keep working to greater understand that problem.
Jason Wilson, with your last 2 minutes, your thoughts?
Yeah, I here in Portland, Oregon, I'm gearing up for on Saturday the 17th. There's going to be a large right-wing rally on the waterfront here, and there's going to be a counter-protest, a left-wing counter-protest. And, you know, the rhetoric surrounding these events and all of the other things going into this have me really concerned that this event and other events throughout the rest of the summer will be potentially explosive. So, that's what I'll be thinking about going forward. And that's another area where these kinds of ideas, these kind of tensions play out. They play out in these large public events, which are also increasingly violent.
Thank you so much, Jason Wilson, Australian-born writer and columnist for The Guardian. Also, Will Carlos, a correspondent for Reveal. So grateful for your input this hour. And earlier in the hour, we spoke to Esmeralda Bermudez, a staff writer at the LA Times. Thank all of you for joining us, and thank you for listening. Sorry we couldn't get to all of you. To listen to past shows or to sign up for the podcast, please visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio, and email your show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihe Raz is on, produced today's show. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call.